The following program may contain subject matter and language not suitable for all ages. If you are sensitive to true crime details or adult language, perhaps you might want to check out some of our other shows on the network, which are safe for all ages. So with viewer and listener discretion advised, let's get to the show.
Hey guys, Mike here. So before we get to today's episode, I wanted to make sure that I put this right here. I wanted to give some credit to the source that we use for the information on this discussion in our two-part series on David Russell Williams. So on top of a lot of different podcasts that I listen to, a lot of different videos and documentaries that I watch, one of the main sources of today's subject is by Patrick Legenti from Vice. He did a wonderful series called Top Officer in the Military, also a serial killer. So check that out on Vice and also some of the other great true crime podcasts and videos about David Russell Williams. So with that, please enjoy this conversation, our two-part series on the former colonel turned killer, David Russell Williams. Enjoy.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More. My name is Nicole Mancha, and I am joined by my lovely co-host, Alex Mercado.
Hi, guys. It's good to be back. Obviously, I've been gone for a little bit, was going through some personal issues. Nothing too bad. But definitely appreciate Mike, Nicole, and the fans letting me deal with it, letting me kind of take my time to come back. I'll be honest, there was a point where me and Mike were questionable if I was going to come back, if I could. I think we talked about if I couldn't give everything to the show, then maybe just stay away in the nicest way possible. And it was one of those real things I had to sit down and definitely started the year off rough. Rougher than I thought it would have, but turn it to hope, and I can say I'm doing better than ever. Honestly, I feel like I've learned more in 2 weeks than I have all last year, almost good and bad. I feel like I wasted a year. At the same time, hopeful what I've gotten done so far, big things in my personal life. But I just want to give a big thanks to Mike and Nicole for holding the fort down and kind of allowing me to come back. And I'm really ready to kind of put a lot forward to this now, and I kind of fell in love with this again, being gone from it. Me and Mike have been talking all week about how excited I am to come back and watching movies again and murder mystery again, and just very excited. But I wanted to start off by saying thank you to you two for being the crutch. I think the one thing I can say is lean on your family. I think that's one mistake I made, is sometimes we all take family for granted. And I think that's something that's what family's for. That you can take them for granted, and then when you need them, they're still the first ones there. But let's get to a lighter note. Let's talk about a perverted war guy, right? That's the nicest I'll ever be on the show.
I was about to say,
everyone knows.
Can we record, like, keep that, like, in the
We're
vaults.
Not recording now, right? That was just for our own personal use. This isn't going to go on the show, right, Mike?
Yeah, nothing goes on.
I get an extra thanks, though, right? Because I had to listen to Mike all by myself.
He's hilarious. I don't know what you're talking about, Nicole.
Alex,
I don't fake laugh ever to Mike.
And welcome back our other co-host and wonderful producer, Mike Mercado.
Oh, it's all downhill from here. It doesn't get any better.
I'm about to take this train right down.
Welcome back, lovely Nicole. Welcome back, good brother. And welcome back, everybody, to the second part of our series in what has been a very fascinating way to start 2020.
Oscar snubs or wrong show?
No, wrong show. We are talking about the killer and former colonel in Canada, David Russell.
He's Canadian?
Yes.
Oh, that's even more interesting now. Canadians are perfect.
Before you were here, good brother, we went into real detail of what he was telling the police officers of his crimes and going into great detail. And where we left off was for his first murder.
All the good stuff.
After hiding in her basement for half an hour, Williams attacked Marie France with a flashlight, knocked her out, bound her, covered her mouth with duct tape, took some photos, and dragged her up to the bedroom. Then he set up a video camera and raped her repeatedly. Now, of course, if you've missed the first part of this series, we are really using discretion here, that this episode gets very graphic. And if you don't heed my warning before every episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More, here is one more. This episode gets very, very descriptive.
You couldn't
and very
ease
dark.
Me in with like a betting scandal or something, or like a celebrity getting his dick shut off or
no,
something?
2020, we are going
all
the way.
Hard, huh?
As the Crown prosecutor described it, she continued to struggle against him and begged him to leave and spare her life. He told her to shut up, put duct tape over her nose, and she suffocated to death. Now, Nicole, I've actually heard of a – this murder reminded me of something that happened a few years back. There was a bunch of muggers came into a house of burglars, and they took the house owner, and they put him on a chair, and they duct taped his mouth. The thing that really kind of freaked me out is he had a cold, and he had a stuffy nose. And because they ducked his mouth, he couldn't breathe.
And he suffocated. Into manslaughter instead of just armed robbery. I remember the story.
And there's something just so disturbing about being suffocated that way that always just tweaked me out of
Well, because you know it's happening. Like, it's in some cases, everything is happening so fast. Your adrenaline is pumping so hard. But, like, in this, you are so keenly aware of the situation.
So Williams cleaned up and drove to Ottawa for a meeting. The murder of the 38-year-old must have temporarily satisfied something because Williams didn't strike again for nearly 2 months. That's at least according to experts and prosecutors and the police in this matter, that after this case, he did go kind of quiet for a little bit. But I wonder how much of that had to do with more scheduling and a little bit of the edge is off, but that could just be coincidental.
He's a sociopath. He's still maintaining a normal sort of life, so... Like you said, it could just be a scheduling thing. Like, to him, it could have been, like, the next day almost. For him, it felt, because he was working so much.
He was very dormant until January 27th, 2010, when he drove past the Belleville home of 27-year-old Jessica Lloyd as she was working out on a treadmill.
Working hard and...
this is not a good one.
It's not going to turn into that.
He told Smith he thought she was cute. And so broke into her home the following night as she slept. Again, he beat and bound her, put duct tape over her eyes, and set up the video and camera.
Here's his biggest fault. You never bother someone when they're working out, guys.
Yeah, well.
That's creepy. You leave them alone.
Well, and...
That's his biggest thing, honestly, well, that maybe I'm upset about.
This might be the biggest thing. He then raped her repeatedly for hours, pausing to take photos. At around 8 p.m., almost 20 hours after he first attacked her, he told her he would take her home. But as they were leaving, he struck her on the head and strangled her to death. He wrapped her body in a blanket and left it in the garage. That was a Friday. Williams drove to the base that evening, flew the following day, and spent the rest of the weekend at his home in Ottawa with his wife. This is always... throwing me off about people like Ted Bundy, because you're watching a documentary about him, Love
I'm
Nicole.
I'm listening to the audiobook of The Stranger Beside You by Anne Rule.
Oh, okay.
So, what tweaks me out and what really just makes me feel so dirty is you hear these serial rapists, right? Especially the ones that are family men. And then they go home and have sex with their wife. It's like, these guys are so... dirty, so depraved. They're not practicing safe sex and healthy sex, and they're spreading their own germs to all these different women. And the women, the wives who aren't unexpecting this, what he's doing behind their backs, like, there's something so deprived on that level too, so grimy to me.
It's creating multiple victims at this point.
Yeah, and it's like, the thing is on top of all of that, you have these women who find out after the fact. To know that they were even entangled in this with someone who's just so disgusting.
Well, I'm talking about, like, STDs, too. No, it's like, imagine a wife wondering,
that's completely dangerous.
Like, just the idea of, like, these predators, like Ted Bundy, having sex with raping all these women and having sex with partners. And it's like, there's another perversion to that. It's like, it's one thing. We always think about when, in the simplest terms, of somebody cheating on their wife and then bringing home chlamydia. And they're like, well, I didn't have that, so how did you get that? It's that weird, like... another kind of raping that they're doing, that they're now spreading this other disease. That's what really tweaks me out about these type of
things. From what it sounds like, he's picking more wholesome and
girls? That's a dangerous thing to say, because the thing is, you have to remember that it does not matter about the person that you're sleeping with, it's the person that they slept with. So this woman could be like she's only slept with her husband, but her husband may not have only slept with her. So that's the thing that people forget, is that there's all these other things that happen. But on top of that, for me, it's like thinking about it is the idea of like men cheat on women cheat on men, things happen. It is what it is. You know, like cheating happened, STDs can get spread regardless. My bigger issue is these women who have sex with this man and then find out later, like, the horrible things that he did to this woman, and to know that essentially, like, you will help, like, you were part of the victimization because you didn't, cause there's a lot
could
of guilt.
You have
it's
done
always
more.
A,
could you have known?
It's
could
a survivor's you, yeah. guilt thing.
Exactly.
He returned to Tweed the following Tuesday, that was February 2nd, and disposed of the body in a wooded area not far from his home sometime around midnight. Lloyd's disappearance was certainly noticed. She was popular. And her family was well known. Durkin, the radio reporter, described her as the girl next door, according to media reports. Quote, a lot of people were on edge. And I think people that either lived alone or didn't have anyone around were just feeling of uneasiness that was in the air. The Ontario Provincial Police were investigating and had found distinctive tire tracks and boots prints near Lloyd's home. On the evening of Thursday, February 4th, they erected a roadblock on Highway 37, which connects Belleville and Tweed. Every motorist was stopped as cops tried to find a match. Among those stops was Russell Williams. Luckily for them, Williams was driving his Pathfinder and not his BMW. Cops made a match and invited Williams in for questioning that Sunday, February 7th. When Williams first walks into frame in the video of the interrogation room at Ottawa Police Headquarters, he exudes the calm confidence of a man accustomed to being in charge. He chews gum as he chats with Detective Sergeant Jim Smith, like he doesn't have a care in the world, but is eager to help. He's offered coffee and the opportunity to call a lawyer and turns both down. They then go through his whereabouts that past week or so. Smith sits back, not consulting notes, just offering small encouragements to Williams as he builds his story. And before we go on with the actual interrogation, there is something unique about this story that we talked about last week, good brother, is almost the arrogance and the self-righteousness of this successful, and I don't want to be clickbaity or whatever, but a successful white guy that has gone through the military.
White military man.
Military man. And like, we're talking about military men, like his accolades. He is somebody that has dominated in the system, and for him to think that he's in control of the situation. And it's funny because certain types of cops and certain types of people would allow this type of person to take advantage of them. But it takes a very clever type of and very intuitive type of detective to watch and smell that bullshit.
I'll be honest, that's like that's probably the scariest thing you see on like I was watching Law and Order the other day. The scariest thing you can see is a powerful white man in the military, one of the higher ranking men, because you're like they really are almost untouchable. Their clout really stretches so far that it is kind of terrifying to be, especially a woman. In this case, like, who's really going to believe you over this Captain America, in this case, Captain Canada over there? He's supposed to represent everything good about your soldiers out there, and, like, he's the biggest criminal of them all. So I always find something terrifying about a military man at that statue doing something like that, because what can you really do? Like, they're backed up by literally Uncle Sam.
Their version of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like,
yeah,
say
that
the
idea.
American version. Like,
yeah.
Any sort of high-ranked military man is almost has the illusion of I'm untouchable.
Yep. And at one point early on, Williams seemingly worried that his being questioned by police might embarrass both him and the Canadian forces. He even asked Smith if they will be discreet. Now, let me ask you this. If this was just the average schmo black guy in New York, do you think he would go up to the sergeant, the detective sergeant, and say, hey, can we keep this
but
discreet?
That's what's scary. It's like, imagine being this regular beat cop or even a normal detective in Canada thinking, like, man, if I don't have 100% proof, like, I really got to be careful with this because, like, this man can ruin my life right here.
So Smith says they'll certainly try to be. They talk for over an hour, and piece by piece, question by question, the viewers can see that Smith is quietly but methodically backing Williams into a corner. Eventually, Smith breaks it down for Williams
investigators discovered tire tracks behind Jessica Lloyd's house that matched the tires on his vehicle.
So this is a good detective we're talking about. This is a good guy.
And it took a little bit of a break. Remember, he had the BMW. So if on that day, when he's on that checkpoint and driving that car, they never, at least at that moment, they don't catch him. And obviously, he's not going to be a keen suspect in any of this. He's one of the top-tier military men. But a little bit of luck and some very intuitive eyes help him get to this point. A witness saw a vehicle behind Lloyd's house that is consistent with the description of his Pathfinder. And the wheelbase width of the tracks behind her house matched those of said Pathfinder. Smith, still using the same calm, quiet tone, says, "The problem is, Russell, every time I walk out of this room, there's another issue that comes up. And it's not issues that point away from you. It's issues that point at you.
Get him.
And I want you to see what I mean."
Get him.
Smith pulls out photos of footwear impressions recovered outside Lloyd's house and prefaces his next move by telling Williams that footwear impressions can be as unique as fingerprints.
That is kind of interesting. I have seen that a lot where, like, you wouldn't think so because there are so many shoes in the world. And I mean, look at you and me, Mike. I think we have three matching pairs of shoes.
Seriously. Yeah.
It's just what you do. You buy from similar stores or whatever's in style nowadays, whatever. So I think it is fascinating how they're very quick about, like, from size to this one indent to, oh, that shoe had a tear mark. Let me see. Like, it's fascinating how many footprints and shoe prints they really do get and solve cases off of.
Well, because a lot of it also has to do with the pressure of, like, where the pressure points of the foot is and when people are walking, what that is. I mean, these also could be because of what he did, because of the military, he probably had specialized shoes. So he had shoes that he had to order and bring in. So they are already things that not every person has, which helps in this case because you have something that's a little bit less traditional, I guess.
So then Smith pulls out a photocopy of the boot that Williams took off his foot earlier that day. Quote, "Now, not an expert at footwear impressions," says Smith, "but these are identical." And it was in that moment we see Russell Williams' whole world collapse.
This would be a great episode of, like, NCIS or something.
It takes a little while, but Williams keeps nodding, looking at the photos, nodding, saying nothing. This goes on for some time as Smith asks for an explanation. Quote, "I don't know what to say," Williams mutters. Then comes the kicker. Smith lays out some documents in front of Williams and tells him search warrants are being executed at his homes in Ottawa and Tweed, and that his vehicle has been seized. Quote, "Your wife now knows what's going on," Smith tells Williams. Now, Lovely Nicole, on the last episode, remember how I told you that there was this weird sense and this weird pride and privacy that Williams had, but it's also the thing that really frustrates me is about the type of crime he has and then the chameleon of him to be a family man, kind of like BTK, why I hate, and I don't want to do an episode about BTK, but we will do an episode of BTK at some point.
I mean, we have to. Right.
But this is why. As Smith is going through this, adding that they expect a complete analysis of DNA found on Marie France's body, that Williams' office is going to be searched, that his credibility is vanishing, that he doesn't think he's a psychopath, and that the search for Jessica Lloyd's body will continue until they find her. Williams is coming to grips with the end of his life as he knows it. He can only continue nodding, picking up the photos, putting them down, sighing, crossing his arms, saying almost nothing. For over an hour and a half, Smith is quietly, even gently, convincing Williams that it's all over and that it's time for him to help them find Jessica. The one constant that Williams displays throughout the entire interrogation is concern for his wife. Now, he wants to minimize the impact of the investigation on her, and that when he folds and agrees to tell Smith everything, where to find Jessica's body, how he broke into the homes of his victims, what he did to them, the details are grisly and chilling, made even more so as William uses the same expressionless monotone as he reveals his crimes. He tells Smith where to find the memory cards he used to record the photos and videos he made of his victims, including the sexual assaults. Smith takes it all in, his demeanor as calm as ever. At one point, Smith asks Williams, "Why do you think these things happen?" I don't know, he answers. Have you spent much time thinking about that? Smith asks. Yeah, but I don't know the answers, William replies. And I'm pretty sure the answers don't matter. Now, hours after the announcement of William's arrest, police services across the country reopened unsolved homicides case involving young women in the areas where Williams, a career military man, had previously been stationed. According to news reports, police began looking at other unsolved cases based on a full statement that Williams gave to police. In addition to four primary incidents, the investigations into Williams included probes into 48 cases of theft of women's underwear dating back to 2006. In the searches of his Ottawa home, police discovered stolen lingerie that was neatly stored, cataloged, and concealed. In April of 2010, Williams was placed on suicide watch after he tried to kill himself by wedging a stuffed cardboard toilet paper roll down his throat.
Let him.
But it's pretty intense, right? You have this guy who was so brutal, so maniacal, and then also he was so OCD with ODD with all his things, you know?
OCD.
You were very close.
Yeah. My ADD and my dyslexia picked up. And then you see that at the end, after he confessed everything, and he was worried about his image and the vanity of being a military man. And then he tried killing himself this way before he even hits trial.
Because it's a power play. The whole thing has been power.
He wants my own life.
Yes, and he wants to control these women, and it's all about power. And now he doesn't have the power. And the reality is a lot of time they fight for power because they don't feel powerful.
And that should make you feel somewhat good, as this military man rose so high, and where normal men would be proud. And, you know, that's a powerful position that he never reached the power he truly desired. So there's something I find good about that, where no matter how hard he tried, he never reached the power he really wanted to. So I find that, what's the word?
Cathartic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it is cathartic, where I appreciate that. Like, he never reached his peak of power to him.
In September of 2010, Williams pled guilty to all charges against him, and Ontario Supreme Court Justice Robert F. Scott sentenced Williams to 2 life sentences. Along with the murder charges, Williams was charged with breaking and entering, forcible confinement, and the sexual assaults. Describing herself as also a victim, his wife divorced him, which, rightfully so. If she didn't know anything, and this is, I wanted to insert this here. From the research I did and the articles I read and what this conversation was based upon, I didn't see her as being knowing in all this.
No.
And here's the thing, somebody like Williams can get away with it, because if you didn't know anything, right, he wouldn't be unassuming. It would be very unassuming. So why would a wife assume, especially with the job details that he does have? It kind of plays into it. So maybe, and let us know in the comment section below, or yell at us, whatever you guys want to do on the interwebs. Let us know if you do have any articles that says that maybe she didn't know a little bit more than she puts on. But I think it's easier to blame her than it is to kind of, because you want to put as much blame as you can on them. You know, like, you just want to put vitriol to all them.
Well,
you know?
And I think you can say, like, maybe she thought he was cheating on her, but that is a very different scenario, because most women know if something's
up. Maybe
she
did have a feeling. Maybe right, she did sense
but
something.
No, woman's first thought is, oh, he's raping and murdering women. Yeah, exactly.
So the couple was sued by his victims and their survivors, and out-of-court settlements have been reached in all of them. He is currently serving his sentence in Port-Cartier, Quebec, about 150 kilometers north of Montreal. Some of the photos presented on the first day of his trial were published in several newspapers. As some newspapers explain, although troubling, the photos were published because they captured the essence of the crimes of Williams and show the true nature of his crimes. Also sales. Yeah. Among the news medias that published some of the released photographs were the Montreal Gazette and the Toronto Star. I just wanted to point that out there, because all media is the same media. They all want to go for ratings, and I don't want to hear that these crimes are because of this. If he wasn't a colonel in the Army, you think it would have been mainstream news like it is up there? So let's keep it real. Now, on Monday, February 8th, 2010, think about how fast that turnaround is.
Right.
February 7th, he was asked to come in. That Monday, the Canadian forces announced that an interim commander would be appointed to replace him and removed his biography from the Department of National Defense website the following day. and what is believed to be a first, William's uniform was destroyed through burning by the Canadian forces as his name had been stitched into the fabric. His medals were also destroyed, and his Pathfinder was crushed and scrapped. Since his arrest, both the Canadian Armed Forces and the residents of the Tweed-Belleville region have been trying to put Russell Williams behind them. He's been dishonorably discharged from the Canadian military, stripped of his rank and his medals, uniforms, and commission scroll confirming his status as an officer in the RCAF were destroyed. They did everything they can to erase him from history.
Honestly, I'm impressed because we see it so often with, I mean, like, I'm a big military supporter, but, like, we can support our, you know, our men in arms, but the Army is notorious for, like, putting these things under the rug and just kind of being like, shh, it's not here if we don't look at it. And with this, like, yes, it was very publicized, but there have been publicized events that have happened with not everybody being held accountable. And in this, they were like, nope, absolutely not. This guy doesn't exist in our lives.
Well, that's good. It's almost like they blackballed him where they're like, we abandon you. You don't belong with us anymore.
Mm-hmm.
However, he will continue to receive a pension.
Of course.
In Belleville, Tim Durkin told Vice that the community still reveres the military. And while the Williams case deeply shook it, while it was unfolding, quote, people are trying to move on from it at the same time. For people connected directly to it, they'll never be able to move on. I think that the community will never be quite the same as it was before. But at the same time, I think people are pretty resilient and are able to overcome a lot.
I do wonder with the pension, though, because he's unable to really access it. I'm wondering if his ex-wife got it because maybe during the divorce, which makes me feel a little bit better because it's not, she didn't do anything wrong. You know, from what you've read and kind of what we've heard, she hasn't done anything wrong. But a lot of times military wives, when they get divorced or things happen, they get the shit under the stick because they've moved so many times, their career just doesn't really exist anymore.
So here are some fun little tidbits that I found from experts over the last 10 years of this case that have gone on Vice, who was one of the main uses of this, one of the main resources I used for this episode. So according to forensic psychologists contacted by Vice, Williams, for all his brutality provisions, wasn't a psychopath. He's something scarier. A man with powerful sexual deviances coupled with a lack of empathy for his victims, but who was able to control his urges in order to avoid detection. Unlike psychopaths, who lack that self-control and are relatively easy for police to catch, Williams was able to exercise judgment and discretion when necessary. That's what makes a guy like that difficult to detect, said Liam Ennis, a forensic psychologist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. He's got the simmering cauldron that is sexual deviance, but he's also got the good working frontal lobe that allows him to hit the pause button. There's no way to detect criminals like Williams, according to Ennis. You simply must work backwards. Quote, you certainly want to talk to sexual partners, says Ennis. You would presume that for this type of serial predator, he's got a lot of hostility towards women. Maybe that's so obvious it's silly to say it. And he's got a clear sexual deviant streak in him. So you want to know from his past girlfriends and his sexual partners, did you see any of this?
So it's interesting because this is the part that I'm actually in Beside Me in Anne Rule's book, is when they talk to Ted Bundy's girlfriend, like his longtime girlfriend, and asking, and she was like, well, this happened and this happened, but none of it seemed necessarily violent all of the time. It was just things that were different. So he wanted to try anal sex and he wanted to, you know, tie her up. But like, it wasn't necessarily aggressive towards her, but it was things that weren't part of the norm. And it seemed that he would be upset or disappointed if she did not want to partake. So it wasn't like a normal, like, oh, let's try this. And, oh, you're not into it. Okay, that's fine. It was more like, very disappointed by it. And then he bought a book that he was like really into. So it's things like that with like with Williams. It's maybe it wasn't anything super obvious, like he got violent with her when they were having sex, but it could have been less interested in having sex with her or wanting to do something and being extremely disappointing or not being able to become erect because of it. Things like that. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be doing the exact same thing to her.
It's a thin line. Humans are complicated. If it was that easy to figure out, there'd be a lot less serial killers and serial rapists out there where it's hard because it's anything in life you can think about where you look back and you're like, you know what? Now I do see that differently because of hindsight. So hindsight's a bitch. And if it was easy, there'd be a lot less crime.
Now, paraphilias, like Williams, usually are in the teens and 20s. So Ennis and other experts believe that he has the impulses which eventually drove him to murder for decades.
Well, this is kind of like what we had talked about a little bit last week, is that I would be shocked if they didn't find some sort of like peeping Tom back when he was younger. And maybe he just didn't get caught, but that typically is the start of a lot of these.
Quote, people don't wake up in the morning and think, you know what? I'm going to become a sexual sadist today. And I'm going to sexually assault and torture and murder a female colleague today, says Mark Oliver, a professor of psychology at the University of Saskatchewan, who told Vice, so the thing is, where on earth does that come from? Oliver suspects that the first break-in in September 2007 wasn't Williams' first experience of giving in to his urges.
I mean, the first thing I think about in the morning is, how did Homer Simpson get a job at a nuclear plant without a college education?
Quote, the guy could have been stealing clothes from his friends and acquaintances, shopping malls. He could be having fantasies of bondage and so forth. He could have been aggressive with partners during sexual acts, but flying under the radar. And over time, fantasy and maybe loosely consenting partners doesn't quite fit the bill, escalation and severity, he said. Oliver also points out that BDSM fantasies aren't in and of themselves indicators of paraphilia, but can certainly be healthy expressions of sexuality between consenting partners. So essentially, you can't, one doesn't equal the other.
Yeah, because there's plenty of people that have kinkier, different sex styles, and they're totally fine, normal people of society.
But I do wonder if he kind of let it veil what he wanted originally.
Sure, maybe.
And used it as a kind of, you know, like, light-veiled kind of crutch. Like, oh, no, I'm just into this kind of thing. To get into that world, to get some of that satisfaction until he just couldn't get it from that anymore.
According to Ennis, people like Williams, quote, manage their behavior in ways that don't bring them to the attention of authorities. They can sit back and resist and wait for a more opportune time, depending on the balance between the push of the drive and how good their impulse control is. And it looks like this guy's escalating. He gets more and more preoccupied with his deviant sexual fantasies. So the push becomes stronger than the impulse control, and you saw him getting sloppy. And that is our series of the former colonel turn killer, David Russell Williams.
I'm glad we kept the light. Yeah, real light.
To start 2020.
What did you think, Alex, since you weren't here last week? So you kind of got thrown
in. It totally
in.
Feels like a dramatization. Like, I feel like I've seen this episode on Law & Order, or I've seen it in a Netflix original 90-minute movie where it almost feels like a movie because you think this guy is going to get away. You think he's going to get away with all of this because the fact that he still got his pension is crazy to me. It's like, you did a lot of terrible things. You're probably one of the worst human beings in the world, but you're going to get paid. You did work for that money, man. Like, that's crazy to me how, like, really? Like, he still gets that? Like, we're not going to give that to victims or put it back? Like, they were so okay with, nah, we'll pay him still.
Well, we also don't know, though, because the cases that happened, the civil cases, we don't know how much he had to pay. So he may have to pay that from his pension.
I mean, I'd hope so.
I mean, I hope it's going to not him. Like, that's my only hope.
I hope he's
that
not too comfy in it's jail going with, like, menthols and Swiss rolls and, like, ramen.
I think he'd still need someone to, like, access it for him, though. So he
guys
wouldn't
like this
be able
find
to.
People, though.
And we hope you found this episode and this series on Murder, Mysteries, and More very enjoyable. Hopefully you enjoyed this conversation we had. And I think for 2020, we much more want to be less like teachers and more like conversationalists, bringing you these interesting cases, these interesting stories. Look, we're not historians here. We're not researchers here.
I totally am.
And I think the main important thing is to make sure that we bring interesting subjects to people. I saw over the last year, I saw a lot of people's very constructive criticism of the show when it comes to what we were trying to be. And I think it's important that at the very least, you know, that we're just essentially a family talking about interesting stuff that we see. And some of it has to deal with the macabre. Some of it has to deal with interesting people, interesting conspiracies, and a lot of stuff that happens in our great city of Chicago, in our great country of the United States, and in our crazy world. But more than anything, we just hope that you enjoy spending some time with us and find these conversations interesting. And maybe it makes you go pick up a book, read another article, get off of BuzzFeed, and see something a little bit interesting around the world. But until then, make sure you guys also follow us all over those same places, including Twitter. I'm at Mike M Media. The Lovin' Nicole Manchas at Typing When Tipsy. And the Good Brothers at Mercado 21.
I don't need your follows. I don't want your
follows. In fact, unfollow
me right now.
We're all on Instagram. I'm at Mike Mercado Media. Lovin' Nicole Manchas at Typing When Tipsy. Alex is at Mercado 2121. Follow us on Facebook at Mercado Airwaves. We're on YouTube.com/ Mercado Airwaves Network, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your favorite audio.
Grindr, Tinder, Bumble, all of them.
Mercado Airwaves, make sure you give us a like. And if you want to support us on one of those other type of levels, a very much more personal level, you could say, visit us at patreon.com/ Mercado Airwaves.
I do dirty stuff.
Home. Alex does very dirty stuff. He will save animals of Australia, and he will show you his butthole like a lot of those porn stars are doing.
I am not getting as many hits as the porn stars.
We tried to. Yeah, it's the same one guy.
I offered to send those pics for Australia, but I got more money to not show that and send it to Australia.
Or,
so, you know, threaten. I will show you my butt if you don't send money to Australia, guys.
And if that doesn't intrigue you, you know, we have interviews with athletes and celebrities that you can get ad-free before anybody else. That's patreon.com/ Mercado Airwaves. For the Love and the Comancha.
Good night, everybody.
For the Good Brother himself, Alex Mercado.
I retract my first 5 minutes of this whole podcast.
I'm Mike Mercado. We'll see you on the next episode of Murder,
Mysteries,
and More
on the Mercado
Airwaves
Network. Who did this when I was gone?
Me.
Hey guys, Mike here from Mercado Airwaves. We want to thank you so much for all the support you've given us here on the network. And if you want to see what we're up to outside of the station, please follow us all over social media. I'm on Twitter at Mike M Media and on Instagram at Mike Mercado Media. You can follow the Good Brother Alex Mercado on Twitter at Mercado21Alex and on Instagram at Mercado2121. The Lovely Nicole Mancha is on all social media platforms at Typing When Tipsy. You can follow the network on Twitter at Mercado Airwaves, our pop culture show, The Good Brothers, on Twitter at Good Brothers Pod, our true crime shows on Instagram at Murder, Mysteries, and More, and of course, like us on Facebook at Mercado Airwaves. You can see all our videos on YouTube.com/ Mike Mercado 2333 or by searching Mercado Airwaves Network. We play video games on Twitch, twitch.tv/ Mercado Airwaves Network, and of course, you can support our network by finding a tier just for you, whether you want early access, you want to be part of polls, you want to win content prizes by visiting us at patreon.com/ Mercado Airwaves. And we really appreciate it wherever you get your favorite podcast to like, rate, review, and share us. And please spread the word. For the Good Brother, Alex Mercado, for the Lovely Nicole Mancha, I'm Mike Mercado. We wish you a happy, healthy holiday season and an awesome new year.